very much. So first I would like to thank the organizers for inviting me here. And also I want to say that I am enjoying very much this workshop. Fantastic work, a rigorous mathematics, so I'm really very pleased to be here. So I'm going to talk about not that rigorous things actually, about mechanogenetics of self-organization of blood vessels and lungs. So actually, an animal, it's a physical object. It belongs to condensed matter physics. So the true understanding of animal formation only ends when you are able to write the supposedly existing entire field of formation. So there should exist some equations such that the animal is its oversight plus the integral over time of all the displacement fields. Maybe I should respectfully say to Eva that I disagree with his statement yesterday that at some point the process should be called biological growth. Any biological growth is actually a condensed matter physics problem, and at some point you have to write down the fundamental equations of the dynamics of the process. So more specifically, a frog, it's the egg, and then the integral over time of what happened. So I'm going to show you some explicit examples that science has reached the moment where you can actually write these equations, and it's probably not too far the moment when you can form an elephant by a simple click on a computer. Wait a bit. So of course these fields, displacement field, you would expect to find it from tensors, analysis of all the mechanics of the problem. It will contain a gigantic quantity of factors, of parameters, coming from genomics, proteomics, evolution, etc. So when there are too many parameters, you will say it's biology, but it's a mix of physics and chemistry. Just let me just show you this. At present, you can find microarrays, for example, for the chicken. I work mostly on chicken microarrays with which you can instantaneously probe about 20,000 genes, and that costs $100. So if you want such mass of data, you can acquire it. Something like a fortnight ago, software was released that can analyze 500,000 DNA sequences in 10 minutes. 500,000 in 10 minutes. Imagine what your life would be if our job consisted in analyzing 500,000 DNA sequences every 10 minutes. Now, the author of this software was interviewed and he says, we are on the edge of a real technological revolution. It will help us how genetic materials determine traits in animals. So there is a bunch of people who actually think that if you want to understand the traits in animals, you need to do 500,000 DNA sequence every 10 minutes. They're probably right, but maybe there are ways of addressing the problems otherwise. Okay, so today my first objective, half an hour, will be on blood vessels. So it's to understand and to describe as flatly as possible the simplest of all organs of all animals you can imagine. So this is an egg, a true chicken egg. This is a yolk in the background, and this round pancake about 4 centimeters wide, it's the generic animal. It's round, it's two-dimensional, it's flat, and it's called the yolk sac. It's more or less the equivalent, not quite, of the placenta. This is a human placenta. So here you have the chicken, and there is some sort of a navel, a belly button over here, which connects the blood inside the embryo to this organ that spans the yolk, sucks the fatty acids, digests the fatty acids, and put them in the stream, and then they go to the baby, and this is how the baby grows. The simplest of all organs. It forms very rapidly, about maybe 2 days. And I will show you that it contains a lot of physics, and it's just physics. From the first second to the last, it's only physics. Now, if you want to understand more complex parts, you need to understand that one first. We've seen since the beginning of the week, if you pay attention to the talks, you've seen eyes, vasculatures, you've seen brain vasculatures, you've seen mesenteric artery vasculatures, you have seen coronary vasculatures, you have seen maybe some other parts. Each of these parts, they were different. They were truly different. Although the endothelial cells are probably just the same. What makes a difference? It's the context, how the local part was built and how the tissue, by all the folds and twists, has brought each part in a certain state of runaway growth that leads to that specific kind of shape. So there is probably some general rules, general principles with scaling laws, etc. But in a given context, there will be a yolk sac or a brain or a coronary artery. So you need to understand the physics of the problem. So if you want to understand the formation of vessels of even the simplest organ, that one, in fact, you need to understand the entire process of animal formation. Because in fact, blood vessels are just a decoration of the body. So if you want to understand the structure of the vessel that you see, you need to understand the piece of flesh which is that. So everything starts more or less here. And let me skip a few mechanical steps and go to the serious part. Starts a few hours later when the spermatozoid enters into the oocyte. What happens? What happens, it enters more or less this little central hole. The inside of the egg separates from the outer shell by some sort of calcium wave, so that avoids polysperm, so that only a single spermatozoid enters. Now something next happens, which is that the inside of the egg, the cytoplasm, rocks in the direction of this entry point. Well, that's why there are a lot of people working on that. That's not my specialty, but anyway, it happens. So as a consequence, the egg has a broken symmetry with inside an axis and a caudal and anteroposterior symmetry. Well, that's a single egg. So this is how it acquires this anteroposterior symmetry. And now it keeps on dividing. And maybe the next day or the next day and a half, it becomes a round mass. So I'm jumping, for experts, I'm jumping from frog to chicken, because depending on what phase of the process we're interested in, it's better to watch frogs or to watch chicken. So at this stage, everybody studies urchin or frogs. At this stage, people study chicken. People don't study mammals for that phase, because mammals are inside a female and just cannot study it. So chicken, you open the egg and you watch. And what you see is that after maybe the next day, this sphere has become a pancake, which contains 20,000 cells, and it inherits from this motion a specific region here, which is crescent-shaped. Maybe it's some sort of a projection of this area, which is somewhat different from the rest of the cytoplasm, or the rest of the blastulum at that stage. Okay, so the large multicellular pancake inherits from a single cell some sort of a symmetry breaking. But there is a chemical symmetry breaking, that the animal is formless, it's round. And now, how does it become a chicken? It becomes a chicken this way. So I've taken this from websites. This is Claudio Stern's lab. So this is what happens. So the previous day, it's round, and a few hours later, you have a body axis, eyes, a tail bud, limb buds. So as you may have noticed, it's a flow. It's very rapid before the animal is formless, round. Let's agree that round means no shape. And 12 hours later, after that flow, it has a very complex form. So what happens? A flow occurs because this area, in fact, is very active, exerts a force, so it pulls the entire blastula. So we don't call it an embryo as long as it has no shape, it's called blastula. And this pool generates a hyperbolic flow, a saddle point. So you can write down equations for this flow, so do that. So you can treat the blastula is very thin, so you can treat it like a Poiseuille flow. You just take into account friction into the plane of the embryo. You introduce a vector potential. You find the equation for the vector potential as a function of forces. And you assume that cells are pooling. So if a single cell is pooling, it exerts a force oriented like that. Okay, suppose a cell is pooling this way. And if you solve for the equations for the potential vector, you find that a single cell has a tendency to generate vortices as it moves. Okay. This explains you, by the way, what happens when a cell moves. When a cell moves, if it goes from A to B, what happened to the matter which was in B before the cell came from A to B? In fact, it went in the back. Cell goes this way, it recirculates toward the back. So we have a conservation law, which is a physical conservation law that cells have to abide by. Okay. So this is why when everybody goes towards this point, which is singular from the point of view of chemistry, the physics of the problem generates vortices. It's just a mere consequence of flow conservation. So if you simplify the problem and say that, okay, it's just pooling in this area, you can find explicitly the flow, and you expect a saddle point, and indeed, there are beautiful studies by the team of Kiesweiger in Dundee. They mapped the flow speed, and indeed, there is a saddle point. And this is the recent progress in this field. There is a saddle point, and that was completely unexpected, because people think in terms of gradients of chemicals. Cells are going up gradients. You would never expect a saddle point from chemical gradients. It's very difficult to form. You can imagine, but it's very difficult to make a saddle point because of, you know, such problems. If you have worlds, if cells go up a gradient, how come that you have circular streamlines? You need a discontinuity of concentrations, and you don't see them. So it comes from the physics that you have worlds, and not only you have worlds, but you have four of them. So it's all right. So I've lost. Yes, it's okay. So if you solve for the equation of the hyperbolic flow inside the blastula, you generate something which is very much resembling the early frog, and I could explain why you have limbs. Doesn't matter for this talk. But you stretch the embryo in this direction, so it's more or less this process, and this is what happens during the flow. The embryo folds and becomes like that. All too easy, but that's physics. Okay. Now, why do we have a yolk sac? It's because in the center of the hyperbolic flow, at the position of the saddle point, you have a high stress, and parts of the cell, instead of escaping each other by a collision like that, hyperbolic collision, saddle point, they go inside. You have two ways when you have a flow from left to right and from right to left, which are heading on the two flows. You have two ways of escaping. Either you recirculate like that, or you recirculate underneath. So parts of the cell do go underneath. Okay. So it's the same movie as the one we've seen before, but from another lab. The previous one was Stern's lab. This is Badger's lab. So if you, once more, you have to see it several times to notice what's going on. Look, here, bang, it opens, and those cells underneath, you can see them, which go away. So what happens is that at the hyperbolic point, it opens, cells go underneath, and now go away. All right? And now the pancake that you've seen is made of cells that go away from the saddle point. And the embryo is made from cells that go towards and away from the saddle point. So the embryo is made from a sheet of cells that is collapsing onto itself, and the yolk sac is made from the same cells that manage to go away from this collapse. So the topology of the embryo at this stage is like a sock. This is the placenta, yolk sac, etc. And the embryo itself is the fold that did not manage to grow away. Does everybody understand this sock? The analogy, okay? So it's an inversion.
Eventually we'll have the head here and the tail.
Okay, so now we are almost there. This is where it starts, the formation of the blood vessels. The embryo is here, and this is what is going away. If you follow mathematically what happens to cells that fall into a midline and move away in their flow, it tends to become rounder as time passes by. And so this is why the yolk sac, before it has its vessels, is quite round. And also, if you follow the streamlines, they are deterministic. It's not random, because the cells, they keep on flowing. So you just follow the streamlines. It's not a random mashed potato-like meat. It's quite oriented, textured. So now you have differentiation. I know nothing about differentiation. Everything I can say is that in this yolk sac, little pools of blood appear. The cells of the mesoderm, they segregate into blood and endothelial cells. So I won't discuss that part. This is just to convince you that cells that go inside follow something like a deterministic flow. Okay. So it may not look exactly what I have described, but I let you in exercise to see what is missing in what I've shown before, which is another little dipole in the tail.
So you agree then that differentiation is not physics?
That what?
Differentiation is not physics.
Oh yes, it is. A great part of it is physics, except that I'm not addressing it here.
Oh.
I'm addressing the pattern of
Have people address differentiation as
differentiation?
As
well, it depends. Either you have chemical inductions that act on the genome by transcription factors to induce cellular changes.
Mm.
But then, what triggers the inductions? Some of the inductions are triggered by previous inductions, and you have some sort of infinite regression and it ends, but maybe at some point it ends, and you understand chemically the inductions.
Mm.
But many of these inductions are induced by forces. I will show it.
On other examples, maybe not induction, but you will see how forces induce things.
So now, let me show you. This is typically the picture of an embryo, as you would observe it by optical microscopy. A flat pancake, very thin, by the way, 50 to 100 microns. You don't see the force field. If you are interested in the deformation field, you would like to see the stress field, all the little vectors, and nobody has seen that. It's very difficult to probe the tensor field with resolution in that kind of system. So we designed a little experiment by which you watch, an experimental setup, you watch the growth by shadow graph. That allows you to see all the relief of the surface, okay? The features on the surface. And you assume that the surface is not flat because it's a very soft membrane. And if you have forces, it will be bumpy as a function of the differences in stress pressures. And you see that it's not at all flat. Now you see some sort of stress map convoluted by this shadow graphic effect. And in fact, clearly, the little pools of blood, etc., are already oriented in some directions. So even before you have blood vessels, there already exists something like a texture in the tissue. So capillary forms by inside your differentiation. So this is a typical capillary loop. Maybe the scale here is 80 microns or so. This is a little capillary vessel. And these corrugations are the drops of fatty acids. I put vesicles, but more like drops. So we start from here. Embryo, yolk sac, capillaries, and beginning of formation of blood vessels. And
modestly, this is where my own work starts. Up to here, it was not my own work. So now, now we have arrived here, and it works. This is how it forms. So now it's the next 2 days. So we've seen the wedding, we've seen the fertilization of the egg, we've seen the imagination of castration, and now that's the two next days. Okay. So you see, it's a very dynamic process. It seems to flow like a paste, like a liquid. So here we are. So this is what you have to understand if you want to understand a blood vessel function. Oh, this is Malpighi. That was found by Malpighi in 1650. By the way, this is an extraordinary picture. Really, truly extraordinary. Because if you were an expert, you would notice that this embryo is twisted to the left. That happens only 1 in 100 embryo. Mm. 1 in 100. Normally the embryo are always turned to the right. But okay, never mind. That's an extremely accurate image, really beautiful. Okay, so I summarize. Circle, up. Embryo formed here. And now you have the circle and the embryo attached topologically. So these two things are twin brothers. One is the inversion of the other with respect to a pole, which is from the mathematical point of view. Same cells. Okay, now you can analyze the growth speed of this pancake, and you find that it's linear inside. It grows more rapidly by the edge than by the center. All right? You can analyze somewhat the stress inside, so you go with a little instrument I will detail later, whether it's stiff or soft, and you find that it's stiffer inside than far away, except maybe by the very edge, maybe it's somewhat stiffer. But so there is a stiffness gradient inside, some sort of stress gradient. So the little instrument we design, it's a micropipette. You blow air through the micropipette. And then the idea is you measure the compliance locally with the micropipette. So you can calibrate on water, ethanol, show that as a function of pressure, you indeed measure a deformation. And this is a typical experiment. Okay, you blow air. So this, it's not a replay, it's five or six times. You see the deformation. So as you deform more, it dries off, but okay. So we'll use that several times during the
talk. Can you elaborate, how are you measuring the deformation? So you're applying this air jet.
Yes.
How are you actually measuring displacement?
How do you measure displacement?
In this particular case, yeah.
That's the trick.
Yeah.
You want the detail?
Sure, maybe later.
They were published 3 days ago.
Oh, comes after, I don't have time.
This is a micro detail. You can make it as small as you want. Well, not too small, you have to have pressure. And now, inside the pipette, there is a glass fiber.
Okay.
There is a glass fiber inside the pipette. And the pipette itself is used as optical guide for the spotlight.
Okay.
So the pipette, the spotlight, is coaxial with the air jet. And that's how you measure the displacement. All right, so same data. So, in fact, if you think of the pancake as cells flowing, they flow over what? They flow over the extracellular matrix, basement membrane, etc. So you can think that cells are some sort of fluid, and the extracellular matrix is some sort of plastic bag around. So you can make some Poiseuille-like approximation. And if you think that it's Poiseuille, make the hypothesis that it's Poiseuille, the flow is very thin, friction is in plane. And you assume, what do the cells do? They suck up the yolk. So you assume that cells have a uniform metabolism. They just suck the yolk. Ah, but sucking the yolk dilates them a little bit. So you have a uniform, I don't know where, a uniform
uniform input of mass, what do you expect for the expansion? You expect a linear speed. Just like just like trees. Think of a cylinder. If everybody wants to grow, you grow more by the edge than by the center. And the center is more stressed than the edge. Simple conservation law. So in fact, this linear speed means that in the long range, the pancake, that's a viscous material. Not quite a liquid, but a viscous material. All right? It adapts, and it's just flowing. We're just paste. Now the expansion, in fact, tends to smoothen the details, because if you have a rough thing, you expand it, it tends to be smoothed off. So you can make Monte Carlo simulation in which you grow tubes by shear stress. You say, okay, if there is shear stress in the capillaries, they want to enlarge. But now we add that the entire thing is expanding away. So each little bit is exerting a micro pressure on the overall thing. So you solve that by a computer, and you find that indeed it completely self-organizes and gives you, with no, almost no input, the rather convincing branching tree. Please note that there is no mention of Kirchhoff's law. So far, people have studied blood vessel formation by adaptation by Kirchhoff's law. But when you do Kirchhoff's law, you don't move around the vessel, and it's just a lattice with vertices, and who cares where exactly in space the vertices are. In fact, you have a constant expansion, and if you want to find the final shape, you need to put the transneural pressure, and the transneural pressure is given by the stress in the tissue. It's the tissue that patterns the vessel. All right, so far, so good. So the kind of physics for people who are not acquainted with it is related to dendritic growth, DNA growth, etc. But now we have some subtleties like expansion. This kind of electric spark or river formation, you don't have expansion of the medium. This is just to prove that this expansion actually exists. So if you follow vessel during time and they just move around. Now there is something else which is rarely emphasized, even for myself as a physicist with a complete discovery, I was completely unaware of that. In early times, flow goes from arteries to veins. This is called the cis-cis path in biology. It's also called first circulation. Now, after some time, nobody knows when, something happens. It reverts completely. New veins form parallel to the arteries, and the next day it's cis trans, they call it. You think that you are looking at tubes. In fact, you are looking at tubes which are stuck to each other and they flow in opposite direction inside. This is called the second circulation, and I call it a metamorphosis, because it's so huge you cannot even think that something like that could happen. So what's the origin of that? Now look, this is arteries, veins. Oh, if you are an expert, you can tell immediately from this picture what are arteries and what are veins. I'll tell you later how you do. So you have arteries and veins. The flow, you see, is from this artery towards this vein. Okay, like that. Like that. Now it's like that. Where did this vein come from? So you see the flow goes from this artery to this vein, and there is something happening here. And now this vein is going to fade away, this disappear completely, and the flow is going to be the other way around. Complete change. If you watch this picture and you don't know the flow directions, you can do whatever model of vasculature, it's just right. So what happens? Again, have a look at the yolk sac by optical microscopy. Veins, arteries forming. Now you look by shadow graph, and you find that around the arteries, there is a swollen area.
Swollen?
It swells. So you can take out the yolk sac, rinse it, it's completely transparent, and you see that indeed around arteries, artery A, artery A, V, vein, the vein is parallel to the arteries in between, and there is some area around the artery which is, so to speak, excluded. There is nothing inside. So you go and you measure the stress, and you find that in this bizarre area, so this is a deformation with the tonometer, it's very stiff, this area. Then it gets somewhat softer, and the vein goes into the softest area. It grows by itself in the softest area. This is an artery which is seen from one end to the other. By the end, the artery is connected to capillaries. Very small artery all connected to capillaries. And here, you could cut it off and take it out of the yolk sac. It's not connected to anything. So how does this happen? In fact, you have this capillary lattice. The artery grows, disconnects, and the strands, disconnected strands, are reused to make the veins, and the artery is disconnected. And since you have one strand, for each strand here, you have one dangling strand, it multiplies by two the available surface area here to make veins, and that multiplies by 16 the conductivity of the path just next to the artery. So you have a gradient of tissue and of porosity or whatever from the artery towards the neighborhood. You can watch that in the brain also. Arteries in the brain generate a vein just sideways. And indeed, as soon as a little artery forms, you can integrate you find that there is a presumptive vein just sideways that recycles everything which was expelled from the neighborhood of the artery. So you can measure the stiffness of these little areas and find that indeed, close to the artery, you have a swollen, very stiff area. This is a fluorescent labeling in the retina, and you see that the artery here is being disconnected from the capillary plexus, and you have these large voids that appear. So, since the beginning of the week, we've seen casts of blood vessels. But when this is a fluorescent image, when you see those images, you just erase the tissue around, and you just don't realize that it's the veins are. The endothelial cells are just doing nothing. It's the tissue around which is shaping the blood vessel. Not just the blood vessels themselves. They are not hanging in vacuum. OK, you can model things. Another effect is the following. Some areas, it's very rough. Some areas, it's very linear. If you go into the yolk sac, the zona opaca has vessels like that. And the zona pellucida, another area, has vessels like that. I don't know what scanning modes are worth, but what I know is that by 5 microns, you can switch from an area which is completely irregular, from an area to an area which is completely laminar, so to speak, blood vessel. How come? It comes from the fact that you have a textural effect during the flows. It orients the tissue. But in addition, you have differences in thickness. And in the area close to the embryo, it's very thin, and the texture of the tissue will influence the patterning of the vessels. And this is well known. If you look at the colon vessels, skin vessels, skeletal muscle, they have an orientation which is very much influenced by what is missing in these pictures, okay, the tissue. And of course, cancer is completely or more disorganized. So now that you understand that physics plays so much a role, you can play with it, so you can stretch yolk sacs. If you put obstacles, it just flattens like a drop of oil. If you put a little obstacle here, it's splits like a viscous fingering. If you have this kind of assay, you can model it. You expect that vessels have to rock away from obstacles, which is not quite the case here, but here it does. Here it's not rocking away, but in fact, a new vein is appearing here. So in fact, instead of moving the existing vein, it makes a new vein completely. And also it may help to understand what happens in the case of twins. So it's very much like a paste. You can also check for the genetic expressions and find that indeed when you stretch or compress yolk sacs, the so-called gene makers are completely upregulated, downregulated by the stress, so they are more markers than really makers.
This is a kind of a series of experiments we did with Ferdinand Lenoble at Collège de France. So here you have a yolk sac with an embryo, and you clamp the right artery. The tissue is still there. The veins, the endothelial cells are still there. They are not dying because it's very thin and they are by the yolk sac. So even if you clamp the blood vessels, they are veining perfectly well. But now if you clamp, after a few hours, the labeling of neuropilin 1 is completely absent. So it's really the flow that induced these cells to be producing NRP1. If you look for ephrin B2, which is a tyrosine kinase-like receptor, it also same thing, et cetera, et cetera, and you tie it to, well, for example, this image, which is an image of staining against the TIE2, if you know that you have these little swollen clusters, now you more or less feel that the TIE2 is actually decorating just the boundaries of the little clusters, not something specific. All right, I come back to say, you can immediately know what are arteries and veins. This is an image of the chorioallantoic membrane. These are the arteries, these are the veins. Immediately. And why do you know? Because if you look at the angles, if you have an angle like that between vessels, where you have an artery, it's pulled this way, and you expect a reshaping of the vertex like that. And if you have a vein, it's pulled this way, and you have a reshaping like that. So here, you see how are the angles, and here you see how are the angles. Now here, in more detail, at a smaller area, smaller resolution, higher resolution, this is the artery, this is the vein, okay? It goes like that. Okay. I exaggerate a little bit, but it goes like that. If we go back to, it's very conspicuous on this image, okay? If you look from far away, you see very well that the density of vessels is much higher here because the angle is more narrow, and here the arteries are more like wide open. It's a purely mechanical feature. Although it needs some mechanotransduction of the signal. Okay, let me finish. Oh yes, this is the brain. And we go to the brain, and you see that in the brain also, you have the same process of transformation of capillaries into veins and arteries. And it's very much obvious that the capillary lattice in the brain has already a texture which is oriented in some stress direction. And it makes such images in the adult quite clear. These blood vessels that you see in the sulci and gyri of the brain, so the folds of the brain, in fact are streamlined. The vessels are oriented in the stretch, which is more or less the stretch is the main gradient of stress. It depends whether it's a liquid or a solid, etc. Okay, now let me take the last 10 or 15 minutes to speak about branching organs. So it's, of course, different because there is no permanent flow inside. So this is typically what occurs in a mouse. This is a kidney. So you have the Wolfram duct, or so, I don't know how to call it. And it starts branching off, and after 24 hours, there are a few tens of branches, and at birth, mouse have 6,000 ducts, and you have 3,000 or so. So when does it branch? It can branch in many ways, either by touching the boundary and tip splitting, or two branches can collide and tip split. Okay. So in fact, there is nothing like a program. There is some sort of a program, but it's very flexible. It depends on the context. And okay, there is an obstacle, I make a branch. There is another branch, no, it's an obstacle, I make a branch. So again, you don't see the stuff around, but it matters. So there are many proofs of the role of forces in this kind of growth. Occlusion experiments have been done on sheep. I apologize, I didn't put the reference, but there is a doctor who did experiments on sheep about 20 years ago. So sheep embryos at a rather late stage, you clamp, you occlude the trachea,
just do track the occlusion on PubMed and you see. And if you occlude the trachea, it increases massively the growth rate of the lung. It's now used somewhat, there are attempts to do it in vivo, even in humans. So there is a medical doctor, Konixia, she does that on dog. You remove the lung of the dog and you clamp the trachea, something how you inflate from the outside, something like that, and the lung regenerates. Mm-hmm. I think it works only on the lung, which is not on the side of the heart. So one of the lungs, it works, the other doesn't. There are many pathologies which are related to the pressure inside the amniotic fluid, oligohydramnios, etc. So it's known that if there is too much pressure inside the fluid, then there are problems to the baby lungs. There are, of course, experiments on single cells, on fibroblasts, etc., on fibroblasts and disease things. And so there is an analogy with viscous fingering in physics. In viscous fingering in physics, you inject air into oil or any kind of material, and it tends to clash. It's unstable. It has a tendency to branch. All right, so we did a number of experiments, my student Mathieu Mbekov. So this is development of a lung. When you go at this stage, which was a stage studied by these doctors, you can show that the lung increases, but you cannot distinguish individual branches. So we did experiments at much earlier stage by day 12, because there you can follow individual branches. So these are 2 days of the normal lung development. Okay, starts here, and next 48 hours looks like that. So there is an average increase of branching number, the double, something like that. So you follow the branching. And what you do is you clamp the trachea. So you just clamp this orifice so that the fluid which is produced by the lung is not expelled. So the lung inflates itself from the inside. Oh, by the way, the liquid that the pregnant women have in the belly comes from mostly these organs which are in the embryos. The kidney, the lung produce these things. They put in stress the organs by which the organs grow, but the excess of liquid is spat into the colon. Okay, so if you clamp the trachea, it grows massively more. Not truly the entire size, but the total developed epithelium. So the lumen is narrower, and the developed surface area is much bigger, up to a factor of 3 in some experiments. And if you follow by PCR the what happens to the genes, the main developmental genes, so tyrosine kinase growth factors, FGF10, which is one of the major growth factor of lungs and limbs, by the way, is upregulated, while the inhibitor is downregulated. Mouse which lack FGF10, mutant mouse, smother at birth because they don't have lungs, but they don't have limbs. Okay, let me go to a little model. Oh, okay, it's in French, I changed it. That must be another version of the presentation. All right.
Just French at the same time.
Okay, sorry, you have to practice a little French. All right, so you have the experiment shows that if you put pressure to the stuff, the growth factor increases. All right? So you understand that this thing should grow faster. But the inhibitor decreases. So you have a brake, which is the inhibitor, and you have the accelerator, which is the activator. But please mind that you grow faster a different lung. It's not that you grow faster the same lung. You grow faster a different lung. How come? The reason is the following. In fact, what produces the growth factor, that's known, it's a diffusible growth factor, is the supporting tissue. It's a tissue around the epithelium. And what produces the inhibitor is the epithelium, so the surrounding tissue, mesenchyme, is saying, hey guys, let's grow. And the epithelium said, oh, wait a minute, let's not grow so quickly. So the point is that as long as you have supporting tissue, it produces growth factor, and the epithelium is dragged towards the outside almost. So it tends to thin down. But when the supporting tissue has thinned down too much, although it produces growth factor, it does not produce enough, and the inhibitor can stop the process. So now, if you put pressure and you increase, you upregulate the growth factor, you need to arrest the growth closer to the boundary to have the same inhibiting effect. Okay? So you have the growth factor. Okay? When you go towards the boundary, the concentration decreases. Okay? But if you increase the pressure, this is opposite to the top. And so you need to go closer to the boundary to stop. And this is why you're going to make a thinner epithelium, a thinner branching and more branching. You can show that there is a specific length in the system, which is the distance of arrest. And this distance of arrest depends on pressure. So you can do, I haven't put the equation, sorry, but there is a bunch of equations. Navier-Stokes inside the tubes, Hooke's law outside. So it's not actually Hooke's law, it's Hooke's law, but viewed as a viscous flow equation. This is the epithelium of mesenchyme. You can solve for the production of fluid at the boundary, epithelium in the lumen towards the mouth, okay? And you can solve for the displacement in the mesenchyme and show that if you are far away from the boundary, you have an incentive for forward growth. We did a very few steps of this simulation, and since I heard the talk, now I understand why the simulation explodes after some time. It's water inside and it's more or less water outside. So I heard that there is a problem if the density of the two materials is the same. So I'm happy I came because now I know. Anyway, you can do a single step. So now if you are very close to the boundary, then there is no growth factor ahead, and there is only growth factor on the sides. And then you keep on growing, but laterally. So this is why you branch. I think. Maybe there are other explanations. Okay, so the reviewer was not happy with the PCR. He said, no, I want in situ images with the resolution of the local effect of the upregulation of FGF10 and sprout. And I can tell you, it's the most difficult thing you can imagine in this field of science. But thanks a lot. Here in Los Angeles, the University of Southern California Children's Hospital, have a bunch of guys who are really good at these things. And Pierre de Morat, he did it. And so this is the control, this is the cauterized one. Control cauterized upregulation of FGF10, downregulation of the inhibitor, and what you see at the gross scale when you study the lung actually happens at the micro scale with all its spatial resolution. So what does this mean? It means that these images are strain maps as they are done in physics, although convoluted by the chemical reaction that produces the FGF10. But the gradient of growth factors are just gradients of stress. So when you see stains of genetic things, careful, maybe they're just strain maps. In this case, they are. Okay, you can show that if you put a bead of FGF10, it goes, but bizarrely enough, in this one, we were not able to put Navier-Stokes in the tube, it would explode the simulation. So we removed Navier-Stokes inside and we just put the constant pressure.
And then you put FGF10, there is a little flux of FGF10, and the finger goes to. So Mathieu was very happy because he had a little movie of this one, but he could not have a little movie of the one with Nadia Stokes inside. Now I know. I will tell him. Okay, so eventually, if you think in terms of what I said at the beginning, you want an equation for V, which is able to be atoms, a generic atom. So as we have seen, it's more or less a Stokes equation, slow flow. The force is oriented by the texture. So cells follow the shear. The shear is proportional to the speed. So there is a volume force, which is the texture. And, chemical attractants, growth factors, that's concentrations, it's grad C, or the grad C is proportional to grad P. So there is a little factor, a correction factor. You can rescale the viscosity, you do what you want. You rescale the viscosity and the force, but in fact, it's a Stokes equation with a force in the texture. And this is the basic hydrodynamic equation for animal formation. This is why you can do this little flow that generates a frog-like, transform the blastula into a frog. Now, as I told you, there are also folds. I didn't mention the folds. This is for in-plane flow. If you want out-of-plane flow, here you have the mesoderm and the epithelium, so to speak. So now, instead of flowing in the plane, you want to find the information out of plane. And you see that when you squeeze, so the little springs here represent the fibroblasts, which produce growth factors. So suppose you squeeze a little bit, you see that if you squeeze, it produces more growth factor. Okay, but since you shrink the thickness, you diminish the size. So in fact, the production of growth factor is proportional to the deformation of the fibroblast times what remains above, because it's a product of how much you have deformed by how thin it's left. So this is a nonlinear production of growth factors which actually arrive at the epithelium. And now this gives you, for the folds, the von Kármán equation. Mechanics know this equation. It's the equation for flexion of solids. And you have here a specific term, which is the growth term, the growth-induced stress. And if you do that, you find that a piece of tissue, which is always an association of two layers, is unstable and should generate little clusters. So this is why I think when you look at the yolk sac, you have these little clusters. Think of a cluster. It's a little piece of flesh that is growing. Okay. Here it does not grow because it's too thin. Even if it's stressed, there are no fibroblasts to produce growth factors. So wherever it's thin, it does not grow. But if you compress a little bit, it produces growth factors. And the result is that there is a wavelength of instability, and you have little clusters. And now the yolk sac itself is a plate of little clusters like that which push each other. So when I spoke of a Poiseuille flow, it's not strictly a Poiseuille flow like a flat thing, but it's a carpet of little peas that are pushing each other. So the conclusion is that there is indeed a lot of physics in the development of the body. It's so obvious. One cannot avoid putting physics into the problem. My feeling is that when people do all these genetic networks, they are looking for something which indeed is absent from the genetic networks, which is a stress field that brings in the same neighborhood this and that cell. So there is no point in looking at genetic interactions between genes. If anyway, the cells which are expressing these genes are just not sitting side by side. See the point? So it's a spatial temporal problem. And to my surprise, if you remove almost all the genetics and just consider the conservation law, and you say, okay, there is a little line of expression, more or less the set of, let's say, all the same there, you make something which looks like a tadpole very easy. So, my collaborators,
my students, Mathieu Mbécan, Tatiana Nguyen, Alia Akilani. Mathieu did 95% of the lung experiments, a few simulations, things like that. Tian did a number of simulations on lung growth and also some experiments. Ferdinand Lenoble is a biologist, so he did all the clamping experiments and the upregulation, downregulation of TRG2FNP4. So the number of genes that we contributed to show that they are mechanosensitive is something like 10. Anemic condition now is at MSC, worked with me on jellyfish and on the chicken. And David Warburton is leader of this lab here at the University of Southern California, the Children's Hospital. And he did all this wonderful genetic work on the lung. And Anna Schmann leads a group of angiogenesis at the Collège de France. And she has discovered a specific receptor of phagocytosate, which happens to be the same as a receptor of the cone growth of neurons. So in fact, neurons, they exert forces by their cone growth with some receptors, which is the same in